You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. There's been some concern with the media's coverage leading up to the war in Iraq. One newspaper in southern Vermont is taking a unique approach. Randy Zimmerman, a Pacifica affiliate WMNF in Tampa, Florida, spoke with Catherine Casa, the managing editor of the Brattleboro Reformer.
The Wire editor and I began to notice that AP has been running a lot more stories over the past few months that lack sources. The stories, it may be a 25 or 26 inch story that hangs on one or two anonymous White House sources. We're not comfortable with that, so we've just decided internally that we will not run AP stories, even if it's what they're billing as their lead story for the day, that we will not use them if they're not adequately sourced. I think the role of a local newspaper or any newspaper really is to provide information to the public and allow them to have enough information to make their own decisions. So I don't feel like running a story that is straight out of the White House from anonymous sources gives anyone enough information to be able to use that to effectively make an intelligent decision, especially when it's something as important as whether or not this country goes to war and whether or not people here or in Iraq are going to die as a result.
Catherine Casa, the managing editor of the Brattleboro Reformer. Well, the press in Jordan faces challenges as well. Almost everyone in Jordan opposes the war against Iraq. One-fifth of Jordan's population is Iraqi refugees, and before the Gulf War and sanctions regime of 1991, Iraq was Jordan's biggest trading partner. But as Aaron Glantz reports from Amman, such opposition has been silenced by more than 250 emergency orders from Jordan's King Abdullah.
Iman Hajjaj is perhaps the Arab world's best-known cartoonist. His main character, Abu Majub, is known throughout the Arab world, but increasingly his work is being censored in his native Jordan. He shows me a strip about King Abdullah's Jordan First campaign that was banned in the Hashemite Kingdom. For every seven strips he draws, Iman Hajjaj says three are banned in Jordan.
I think it's this slogan had been raised to somehow to isolate the people taking any political action with Iraq. Jordan First means forget about Iraq. Do not demonstrate or do anything about it. This is what I think. So what the cartoon strip says, it's like Abu Muhammad talking to his buddy, Abu Mahjoub talking to his buddy Abu Muhammad. And he's like making an introduction to something. So at the first caption he says, "Oh my pal Abu Muhammad, you are my dear friend. You are like a brother to me." So Muhammad looking a little bit suspicious. And then he says, "And I know you have been very good to me for many times, for a long time. And you always pay the bill for me in the cafe." So Muhammad looking more suspicious and says, "Abu Mahjoub, please say what you want." At this moment, there is a big guy coming in, he's USA, the tough guy, and he seems like he want to hit Abu Muhammad. So Abu Muhammad says, "So I'll say it frankly to you, you are my friend, but sometimes, and this big guy, USA, start hitting Abu Muhammad." Abu Mahjoub added, "Sometimes I had to raise the slogan, Abu Mahjoub's first." So he's just letting his friend being hit by the big guy, and he is just doing nothing. This was banned, and also...
These days, Iman Hajjaj is most concerned about his friend, Nasser Kamash, the editor-in-chief of Al Halal Weekly. Last Thursday, Kamash was arrested along with two of his co-workers, and his paper was closed. For 5 days, Kamash has been held without bail in a Jordanian prison. Cartoonist Iman Hajjaj says Kamash is being held because of his opposition to the war on Iraq.
They closed this newspaper because they knew this newspaper used to put a first page headlines saying yes to Iraq or something like that, urging people to do something about what's going to happen to Iraq. This is the main thing.
The official reason for the closure of Al Halal Weekly is a story the paper ran called Aisha in the People's Home, which was a historical article about sex in the home of the Prophet Muhammad. But Iman Hajjaj says blasphemy is not the reason for Kamash's jailing.
Their theme is to take use of the Islamic heritage and history and make some kind of journalist story or a report based on what's happening today. This is the general theme of their newspaper. So when they talk about Iraq, they talk about the Mughals, they talk about the Tatar who invaded Baghdad, and they make this historical comparison. Huh? And it's very effective sometimes with many people. Hmm? And that's why they don't like it, the government. They think it is against, it would be very annoying for them. That's why they close it.
Press freedoms have been under siege in Jordan since last June, when King Abdullah declared a state of emergency, dissolved the parliament, and declared a series of emergency orders. Mahasin Imam is founder of the Arab Women's Media Center. She describes the new restrictions.
Criticism is not allowed, especially if you criticize the royal family. Criticizing the government is not allowed. To be extremist is not allowed. To call names is not allowed. To criticize one government official directly, these are red lines that we cannot cross.
The case that most concerned many activists is that of Jordanian parliamentarian Tujan Faisal. When Tujan Faisal opposed Jordan's prime minister in print, she was thrown in jail for months and only freed after an international campaign for her release. Again, Mahasin Imam of the Arab Women's Media Center.
The free press is so limited. Clearly, frankly, we are not enjoying free speech. It is limited in so many ways. On top of every journalist is the print department. They can censor what's being published in the press and the media. That's what this is about. Censoring by the government.
Back in his office, cartoonist Iman Hajjaj shows me another cartoon about the Jordan First campaign that's been censored in Amman.
You know, this campaign, you can see it in Jordan now, huh? This way, this poster. It says Jordan First. You can see this flag all around Jordan now, huh? So I completed the poster. Make it that the Jordanian people are fighting, huh? So I says, instead of Jordan First, I write Democracy First, huh? Here you could see a man holding a placard says no to government, while the policeman is holding another one says yes to government. Here you could find a woman holding a placard says no to normalization. Normalization means normalization of relationship with Jordan and Israel. But there is a large sector who does not like to normalize. On the other hand, you can find another guy, he seems like a businessman, holding yes to normalization. And here you could find a religious guy, maybe. He's holding a sign says no to America. Another one holding says yes to America. What I mean is before you suggest campaigns to people saying Jordan First and do and do not do, give them parliament. Make election. Let the parties say what they have in mind. Let the people say what they have in mind.
Iman Hajjaj says he's begun to censor himself because he's become tired of having his cartoons nixed by the authorities.
They are saying that we are alliance to America. We are a free country. A free country, make yourself like America. Where is your parliament? Where is your free press? Where is your free parties? Where is freedom of speech in Jordan? None of this exists. What you have is a lousy media campaign.
King Abdullah says he may keep the state of emergency and its rules in place until the Israeli-Palestinian crisis and the Iraq crisis are solved. So there could be many months of censorship ahead for journalists like Iman Hajjaj. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Amman, Jordan.
The World Social Forum is convening in Porto Alegre, Brazil, and Iraq is high on the agenda. What happens when an estimated 100,000 members of civil society gather to discuss alternatives to corporate globalization? In the current climate of an impending war on Iraq, they talk about stopping U.S. military aggression. Monica Lopez and Renee Felt are there and file this report.
The forum's anti-war message took to the streets during its opening day in a march through downtown Porto Alegre. Indigenous farmers joined with thousands of young people and delegates from the forum to march together with the motto, "Another World is Possible," against militarization and war. Police estimates put the number of protesters as high as 100,000 people. Marchers began gathering at the Intercontinental Youth Camp, joining a second feeder march in the city's central market area. Local people showed their support for the protest's anti-war message by gathering at windows and doorways, waving flags, and cheering the marchers on. Many people marching wore World Social Forum t-shirts with the message, "Not in our name," alongside men and women in traditional clothing. Among the numbers from out of town marching against the war was Brian, from Sydney, Australia. Before coming to Porto Alegre, Brian participated in a local social forum constructed on the same model and principles of the World Social Forum. He explains how the theme of this year's forum has been shaped by pending war in Iraq.
I think what the experience is of a lot of people from a lot of countries is that the war is sort of the issue that's mobilising people at the moment. Like, I know in Australia, we've just had the biggest demonstrations lately. Like, we had 50,000 people demonstrate at the beginning of December. And, you know, like, there are a lot of issues, but people see that as, if we can't stop George Bush attacking Iraq, how can we win on all the other issues, you know what I mean? Like, and some people are a bit wary about doing, about campaigning about that, especially the Latin American delegates, and some of the Asian delegates were worried about that too. So I think that's going to be an argument. Like, on the 15th of February, there's going to be demonstrations in Europe, in Australia, I think in North America. We really need demonstrations in Latin America and Asia, you know, like, because I think there's a good chance if that happened, we would stop Bush, you know, if we got, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions on the streets everywhere. And I'm sort of hoping that the forum sort of discusses that through and that we get some sort of agreement about the 15th of February.
Worldwide, opposition against what is increasingly seen as Bush's war is growing, with 3 out of 5 permanent members of the United Nations Council taking a firm stance against rushing into war on Iraq. The world seems poised to refuse further U.S. aggression. For producer Renee Feltz, this is Monica Lopez.
This is not to be overly pessimistic, but as I fight to organize against the war, I want to pick up back on your point. And the disobediente actions are very inspiring, but what power do we have to stop this war, especially with the increasing closure of spaces of opposition?
Let's see. I haven't got an answer to this, okay? I haven't got a clear idea, but I've got some kind of vision as to why or how we can do this. To be honest, even if we were to march in the millions, I don't think they would do, you know, we've had in Italy a march of 3 million people in March this year against for labor rights. 3 million people out of a population of 55. If you do the proportion in the United States with 400 million people, 200 million people, that would be like such a big number. You've never seen anything like that before. So in proportion, it was humongous, okay? That didn't change anything at all. Why? Because we're not hurting them in their interests, you know? We're not, like, as big as marches can get, so long as we're not hurting the direct interests of the people who are ruling us, and these are essentially not only our politicians, but also the industries that are behind them, then we're never going to be able to stop the war. You know, they'll just go, yeah, yeah, okay, okay. So the actions, and I'm not sure how to do this. I mean, I'm not going to say I know how to do it, but this is a kind of sort of strategic kind of direction thing. We should aim at hitting them at the heart of their economic interests, because all they're interested in is money and richness. And so we should try and find a way of hitting them right where it counts. And I think if we find, you know, ideally, what would be the best way of doing it? Like, I'm still talking theoretically, general strikes. You do one general strike one day, 2 weeks later you do another one, 1 week later you do another one, 3 days later you do another one, and then you just go on strike until they decide not to do the war. But there could be other ways. You know, say, start boycotting banks that do, you know, take all your money. We've got, like, in Italy, I don't know if the same is in the States, we've got ethical banks. They've got a charter whereby they do not invest in any... Why don't you try and set up an ethical bank? You know, I don't think it's difficult. It's just a bank that commits not to invest in arms trade and not to invest in any industry where there's been, you know, And loads of people have taken their money out of commercial banks and brought it into ethical banks. That could be a way. That could send us a clear economic signal. Well, that could be one way, start becoming consistent with this type of things. And I think that would send out a very clear signal. If we start thinking along those lines, I'm not saying abandoning the marches, I'm not saying abandoning the rallies, but I think one should also be very creative and try to go at the heart of the matter.
Obviously, whatever we're talking about in the longer term, we do need to do our best to stop the war. And I think everybody understands that in order to stop the war, you have to have a movement that raises the social cost. This is not widely understood among the people, the activists I work with and the people I speak to in the United States. A lot of them still have some kind of illusions that you present the right case to the powerful, that somehow they'll understand what they're doing is stupid and so on. I don't think breaking windows raises a social cost. I don't think even much larger, more significant property damage causes much of a social cost. I don't think any movement in the United States has gotten very far in terms of change by raising the cost by destroying things. Now, there are times when it makes sense, usually when there's some powerful political statement you're making by it. So you're smashing an F-16. Unfortunately or fortunately, you're not making the same political statement smashing a Starbucks window, and it's been noted. You know, when Daniel Berrigan and other people of faith went around smashing weapons in the Vietnam War, it was an effective and useful thing to do. But even then, that wasn't the social cost that was being created that helped stop the movement. That was just a tiny part of it. That's really not the track that has ever been very successful. But what I keep coming back to is the one movement in the United States that was really effective in opposing a war, which is the anti-Vietnam War movement. And I especially want to hear from people who were there. But it seems to me that what happened then that was really almost unique in American history is that every day there was a new front opening up domestically. Things were just exploding. The people in power couldn't even tell where it was going to stop because all kinds of different sectors of society were making their own protests. Most of them never joined the anti-war movement. Most people in the country were against the war and against the anti-war movement at the same time during the Vietnam War. But things were exploding. It also happened simultaneously with the rising of the racialized underclasses in the United States, which also played a major part in trying to stopping that war.
The spirit was, whoever will listen, you talk to. Whoever you can argue with, you argue with. I must have been like a real pest in those days. Whoever you were, you could make up some leaflets and take them out, 100 of them out that day. We had the spirit, a little bit going against what you said before, Raul, that we would persuade everybody because our cause was so right. Now, you're absolutely right. You're not going to persuade everybody. Everybody's not going to become an activist. But our spirit was that was evangelical. That we were on a crusade that everywhere we went.
The most frustrating thing as someone who's been doing activism for 17 years since I was 15 is those stupid debates that especially United States activists are prone to, and I'm sure you guys, the rest of you, are. Is it direct action? Is it a petition? Is it a mess? Is it peaceful? Is it not? And people will, the time that people could just go out and find out if it works and make the road by walking, if it's appropriate for this time, they spend in a room arguing all to hell, tearing each other down, calling each other names. And what I think is really, really important is different tactics are appropriate for different communities, for different opportunities. I prefer things that are outside of the electoral process. However, I don't rule out voting when appropriate. I favor direct action, although I wrote a book about civil disobedience. But what I think what we need to do is kind of to take a phrase from our friend Michael Howard, is kind of map out a possible trajectory of change that starts off with, hey, if you're getting somebody who's never been anti-war to sign a petition or do a petition drive, that's positive. It might not be as interesting for those of us who are more used to kind of running around at night and disrupting things. It might not be as interesting, but it's very useful. And so, if we have a kind of map out a trajectory of change that involves economic disruption, but involves popular education, involves rendering electoral consequences for the John Edwards of the world, then, which I heartily applaud. I think that's useful in this, and just knowing that and completely discarding with the kind of the moralistic, sectarian crapola that we've all been brought up on.
One of the five thematic areas of this year's World Social Forum explores how to combat militarization and promote peace in a democratic world order. Today, one of the area's subtopics was addressed by panelists in a discussion about the rise of U.S. unilateralism. Current U.S. foreign policies leave little room for achieving the forum's goal of making another world possible. Essentially, panelists argued, U.S. hegemony makes a peaceful world impossible. Panelist Fernando Martinez Reja, a Cuban scholar and activist, explains how the World Social Forum is helping to change this imbalance.
This social forum is another expression of the power our movement has. We involve a huge cultural accumulation involving several activities which result from the struggle against feelings of several generations that have to face domination. This is a very valuable body of experience, of tradition, of solidarity, agencies of thought, of struggle, desires, questions, lack of conformity. The imperialistic force is now forced to recognize the force of this rebel potential. The United States tries to neutralize this force or tries to force us to forget it. In the past, they took advantage of our weakness and of our ignorance. Now we're only weak. We're no longer ignorant. Will we allow the imperialists to do away with our culture? We want to protest. We want to denounce. We want to be more aware. We want to be more able to coordinate our efforts, forming an international network. The challenge is to build this and transform our wish to resist. We need to trust ourselves. We need to begin thinking, speaking, and feeling in a creative and daring way what we think about their power. We need to stop being under the United States.
Current United States status as the dominant world power may be weakening as a result of its unilateral policies. This could create a window of opportunity for change. Threatened unilateral aggression by the United States against Iraq represents a rupture in the political and economic framework American leaders have built through globalization. European and Latin American leaders have taken firm stances against such a war. Panelist Roger Burback of the Center for the Study of America suggests that as the U.S. backs out of international coalitions, an opportunity exists for new networks to be built among countries opposed to U.S. hegemony.
I think a narrow clique has come to power with George W. Bush, representing what I would call the military energy complex or the military petroleum complex. It is based solely and principally on petroleum and military interests, and it believes in the need to act unilaterally to secure its control over the world's remaining supply of black gold, or the most important supply of oil or black gold. The military energy complex does not represent a broad consensus of U.S. capital, let alone of global capital. However, before, until September 11th, the efforts of this narrow clique of U.S. rulers to secure its control were floundering. Bush himself was viewed as inept and incompetent, even by the U.S. corporate media. In this context, the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon provided a golden opportunity for the Bush administration to push forward a unilateralist agenda. Even before the Afghan war had ended back in January of last year, the Bush administration had begun to push its unilateralist agenda by announcing the Axis of Evil, which was a propaganda ploy aimed at securing its control over the Gulf oil supplies. Now, I think it's difficult to predict where the international and domestic wars of the administration will take the world exactly. A war in Iraq will clearly open a Pandora's box. In the short term, it appears the world is headed for a terrible period of death and destruction. But given the fact that the Bush administration represents such a narrow unilateralist clique, there is every reason to believe that it will be destroyed by its own war. Virtually the entire world is against the war, and there is no internal consensus supporting it, either as the demonstrations in the United States have shown in the last week and a half, where we assembled several hundred thousand in Washington and a couple hundred thousand in San Francisco, and many regional demonstrations throughout the United States. Given these realities, in the next 2 years, it is quite likely that the United States will experience a major internal political crisis and upheaval. Global capital needs stability and international institutions to flourish. These are the requirements for its expansion of the markets of capital, as well as the development of networking technology, the keys to globalization. Because the global and U.S. national consensus will be fractured by the Gulf War, we are headed, I believe, for a period akin to the domestic and international upheaval that occurred with the Vietnam War. We're already seeing the politicalization of a whole new generation within the United States, and I think in the world at large. The new protest movement will spawn a broad rethinking of social norms, and I think it will help spawn new ideas that we do not yet fully understand. Also, I would suggest the aggression against Iraq also represents some important opportunities in Latin America, particularly South America. It is here, I think, that the major challenge to the paradigm of globalization is being mounted by the governments of the by new series of governments in the region, from Ecuador to Brazil to Argentina to Venezuela. If it were not for the Bush administration's distraction and its obsession with the war in Iraq, I believe the Bush administration would undoubtedly already be playing a more interventionist role in Venezuela and would have even moved against Lula and the Workers' Party in Brazil already. This is the moment for Latin Americans to build a broad continental alliance among their peoples and to collaborate with the social forces in the United States that have been mobilizing against globalization since the Battle of Seattle in 1999. Finally, I think we in the United States, now than ever, as other speakers have said, need international solidarity, and I think particularly Latin America can play a central role in assisting the development of our new politics in the United States. It is the warmongering internationalist clique in the United States that is becoming increasingly isolated, that I think this is the moment, perhaps one of the missions the forum could do is begin to mount on an emergency basis a forum within the United States, perhaps in Washington, D.C. itself, where we bring into play the global forces and insert them directly into the United States. I think this is the moment where you can have a real impact upon helping mobilize internal opposition to this horrendous war which this narrow clique is about to undertake in the United States.
Right now, discussion continues at the World Social Forum of calling for a special meeting to discuss Bush's war. In the meantime, plans are being developed for a worldwide day of anti-war demonstrations on Saturday, February 15th. Organizers say this may be the largest ever mobilization against war, as protests are expected to take place in China, Europe, South America, and the Middle East, in addition to the United States.
That segment was produced by Pacifica Station KPFT reporters Monica Lopez and Renee Feltz, with contributions by Josh Chaffin and assistance from the Brazil Independent Media Center. We'll continue our coverage of the World Social Forum next week. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Keith Chaljian, Bentha Berkland, and Reen Kathuta. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening.